Thank you to everybody that read. My name is Blessing, and I'm an alcoholic and addict. I am a graduate of this fine institution. About 3.5 years ago, I was sitting where you guys were sitting. And right before that, I met someone in Cottage C who became very close to me, and she's actually our speaker tonight. And I don't really remember my first couple meetings in Cottage C, which is now Cottage B, because I was so still trying to get off of the Xanax and opiates that things were a little fuzzy. But I do remember Sarah. I remember her coming in and being bubbly and wonderful, and Joe also was there, and everybody knows Joe is just fills the room, and not just because he's tall. But I knew when Sarah left that there was something really special about her. And when I lived up in residence, I saw her at the Saturday women's meeting, and she was the first person I went to and got her phone number and wrote it in my big book with the pink cover, Cam. And I had no idea the journey that Sarah and I would go on together. It's been great, it's been bad, it's been painful, but it's also been wonderful. My daughter was off at college and was not speaking to me, and Sarah kind of became my surrogate daughter. I'm trying not to cry, but it was about 3 years ago she was standing up here and was trying to tell her story, and she fainted. She started fainting, and it wasn't because she was drunk and it wasn't because she was high. She conquered those demons, but she had another one. She developed an eating disorder, and I'm not going to tell everything about it, but it was scary. And those around us and those at Ridgeview and some of the people in this room helped save her life. And right when she admitted she had the problem, she came to me and asked me to be her sponsor. And I was scared, because I loved her so much, and I felt I was too close to the person. But I also knew I'm a tough sponsor, and I knew she needed a tough program. And so she promised me that she would do everything I suggested, and she has. And I am so, so proud of her, and her story is amazing. Her life today is amazing, and I know mine is better because of her. And with that, not only am I going to have her come up here, but I'm also going to give her her 4-year medallion that she just earned.
Okay, take two. My name's Sarah, and I'm in recovery. Like Blessing said, I tried to do this 3 years ago and did not quite finish it. Cam got up here and finished it for me. I'll go ahead and just get this out of the way. I work on a lot of character defects, but there's some I don't work on. One is cussing, two is energy drinks. So don't mind the energy drinks, and if I drop a few F-bombs, sorry. So I was born June 6, 1992. I am 26 years old. I just turned 26. I grew up in a Jewish household, very jappy mother, extremely involved, extremely addicted to chaos. My sister was diagnosed with a chronic nerve disorder, when I was 9. And for me, that's kind of where my depression started. She was in and out of the hospital to this day. She was on plenty of drugs that my mom liked to keep, which was good for me. And all the attention was on her all the time. The only way I got attention growing up was doing good in school. That was really the only way I got accolades from my parents, got noticed. I didn't start drinking until like senior year of high school, and my drinking didn't last very long. And some people like to say that that means you're not a true alcoholic. I think I just did it better and faster. So there's that. I remember my first drink was a water bottle full of rum. Spring break. I stayed in line. I was a goody good girl, like got straight A's, graduated high school with a 4.2. I got into my first college that I applied to, didn't apply to anymore, early admission. And so this was very out of my comfort zone, but I just remember that night puking a lot and loving it. Apparently, I hung out a lot in the bushes by myself that night with the alligators, I was told. And I remember the next day, my friends kindly dragged me upstairs as their parents chaperoned, and they said, "You can tell your parents or we can tell them." And I said, I'll break it to them. So I got home and I said, "Mom, Dad, I gotta tell you something." And they were like, "What?" And I was like, "I got drunk." And they were like, "Okay." It was not a big deal to them. My parents are not drinkers. They're the one glass, half a glass works for them. And same with my sister, not a drinker. Surprisingly, as many drugs as she's been on, she's not an addict. So they didn't really care, and they didn't really see any problem with it. It's funny because the way my mom speaks about her dad is very highly. I didn't find out until after I went to Ridgeview that he died of alcoholism. He was a binge drinker, and apparently he was a really mean drunk. And I never heard about that side of him. My dad's dad also died from alcoholism. So I had it in the family, but not in my immediate family. And I got into college. I'll say this too. I went to a therapist one time in high school. I hated it. They wanted to talk about my sister the whole time. That is not what I wanted to talk about. The attention was still on her. I just wanted some attention on me. And so I never went back. And I went to college, and I felt like if I got this checklist of everything that I thought you should have in college, I would have this perfect life, and everything would be, I would be happy, and things would finally click. And I remember I joined a sorority, I dated some frat boys, I got to go on mountain weekend, I got to go on date nights, and I still wasn't happy. And I went to UGA, and I thought that I'd be happy there too, but I wasn't. By sophomore year of college, my depression had gotten really bad. I forgot to mention this. The summer before sophomore year of college, I was raped. For me, that set a lot of what happened afterwards. I feel like victims of rape go one of two ways. They either don't want to touch anyone or they want to touch everyone. And for me, I was a lot more promiscuous. It was my way to gain back control. I don't remember that night because I was unconscious, but I remember the next day asking what happened, and the boy who did it said it was all just for fun. And that's when I kind of really disconnected from my body and saw my body as an object. I was no longer a human being. I was an object to be used, and that's what I let people do. So I started dating this one boy sophomore year, and we got really close, and when things started to go badly, he was the only person I had disclosed about the rape. No one else knew about it. He told me he was just using me for sex. So that kind of made me spiral out of control. I ended up trying to commit suicide. Took a bunch of pills, crashed my car into a pole, didn't take into account the safety features of cars these days. They're good. So I walked out unharmed. And that was not the plan. So I called a friend. I don't know how the police didn't get involved, but they didn't. I was still really messed up trying to call the health insurance company about my car. They would not help me with that. And so my friend who I treated very poorly in my drinking, which I treated a lot of people really poorly when I was using. I destroyed a lot of friendships because I put drinking first. I didn't care about other people's feelings as long as I was getting what I wanted. And hadn't talked to her in about 6 months, but I knew she was kind of that doormat friend that, like, you could call when you're in a terrible situation and you could have treated really poorly, but she would still show up. So she did. And she dealt with my car. She got me in bed. My parents found out about my suicide attempt the next day through the insurance company. They got an email about the car being totaled. And they drove up to Athens and asked what happened. And I just said, I don't want to be here anymore. I'm over it. I try and explain this. I talk during family week to the family members of the psych patients, and I always try and explain suicide to them. I remember when I was here at Ridgeview, it was the first time I heard that suicide was a selfish thing. And I literally had to ask the person why. Because in my mind, it was a really, I was doing everyone a favor. I was fucking things up. I was a problem. Nothing was going good around me. I thought about it. I was like, my parents have one more kid. Like, they'll be sad for a few weeks. They'll get over it. No one would be affected by it. And so I went to Cottage C for a week, and that was one of the best weeks of my life, which is insane because it's the lockdown unit of a mental institution. And that was the first time I got to openly talk about my problems. And unfortunately and fortunately, my parents found out about the rape. Through my case manager when they talked, and my case manager said, she did really good at group today. She talked about what happened over the summer. And my mom said, what happened over the summer? And she said, you know, the rape. And my mom said, you must have the wrong patient. And she said, no, the only other patient we had was an older gentleman. It wasn't him. And my mom broke down. She called me crying. And all my parents could say is, we should have known. We should have been able to tell. But I was so good at masking it. I was so good at numbing it out. On the outside, before my suicide attempt, it looked like I had all my shit together. I was doing well in school. I had friends. I was in a sorority. I was at UGA. I had that checklist that I had imagined beforehand, but nothing was going right. I was dead inside. And the drugs and the alcohol stopped working. The only way I knew that would definitely fix my thoughts and my self-hatred was suicide. That was my answer, because I knew that was for sure gonna work. So I spent a week in Cottage City, and I came back to get some of my clothes so I could go to the halfway house and do PHP here. And I remember sitting down with one of my best friends in the car, and she turned to me and she said, "Sarah," and she started crying, and she said, "I would really miss you if you were dead." And that's when it hit me that people would actually notice. I didn't think people cared. I didn't think anyone would be sad. I didn't think anyone would miss me. And that's when I realized that what I was doing was affecting other people. I got to Ridgeview, and I thought I was going to be here just for psych, since it was a suicide attempt. Apparently, when I disclosed other things at admissions, they put me down as dual. And I did not believe at the time that I was dual. I knew I abused substances, but that was purely because I had depression. If I didn't have depression, my substance abuse would be under control. And so I remember also, I was 19 at the time when I came here, and I was crying to Sam Anders because he had done this lecture about being an alcoholic, and I told him it was impossible for me to be an alcoholic. And he said, "Why?" And I said, "I'm not 21 yet." So that's when I found out you can actually be an alcoholic or an addict at any age. So I was able to stay, I guess, on the beam a little bit. I didn't have a program, really. I didn't have a sponsor. I was taking my medication. I was going to a therapist. I came to Ridgeview a lot. But within about 6 months, my suicidal ideation came back pretty badly. And this time, I decided that I would get help. So I drove myself to Ridgeview. Well, a friend drove me to Ridgeview because I was in distress. But she drove me to Ridgeview. My parents were out of town. They came back in town, drove to Ridgeview overnight. And I remember seeing my case manager from the first time. And she said, "Sarah, you've made so much progress." And I was like, "What are you talking about? I am sitting in the access center again. This is not progress." And she said, "No, this is progress, because last time you had suicidal ideation, you acted on it. This time you recognized you were having it and you got help. That's progress." And I was like, "Oh, maybe I have made some progress. Maybe something sunk in a little bit, what they were saying here." So I was able to stay sober a little bit longer, but if you've ever tried to stay sober in Athens, it's not really all that easy. Especially when you're in college and in a sorority and going out every night. And I seem to complicate that even more by thinking that I could bartend as well. I had this thought process that was, they told me that you couldn't drink while you were on the job. Then they changed the rule when I got there. And they made me test the drinks that I made. So that was my start of my relapse. I drank for 2 more years. The month that I turned 22, I was at a wedding. My cousin, this is embarrassing, my cousin's wedding. It was at a winery, and I had a lot of wine that night. A lot of wine. And we didn't see family on my dad's side all too often because they live all over. So it was hard to recognize at the wedding who was family and who was not. So I tried to pick up my own cousin with the classic line, "You play trombone, don't you?" And he said, "I'm your cousin." And I said, "Okay." And I found another boy who was not my cousin. My dad was not very proud of me that night. It was not the best showing in the world. That next morning was June 29th, 2014, and I found out that a friend of mine from high school, who I also bartended with, had killed himself and other people in a drunk driving accident. I don't know if you guys remember back in 2014 when an Auburn football player died. My friend was driving that car. So I went to his funeral, and that's when I woke up. I saw his parents have to bury him, and I knew I was making all the same decisions, but 10 times worse, that he was making, and he had just run into bad luck. I hadn't run into bad luck. I had run into alcoholism. So I said, "I can't do this anymore." And I came back to Ridgeview, not as a patient, but as an alumni. And I was really lucky because I got sober 6 days apart from Joe. And people were very suspicious of me and Joe at first. It was an odd pairing. If you know Joe, we don't look like we go together. But we hung out almost every single day. We played basketball here. We did Cottage C almost every night together. He helped me a lot in my sobriety. And soon after this, I moved into my own apartment, and that's kind of where my eating disorder started. Growing up, I had always thought of myself as bigger than my friends. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. And since I got sober, I had a lot more time on my hands that I could dedicate to staring at myself in the mirror and critiquing myself and standing on a scale. And living alone, I didn't have to buy food. And no one came to check on me. And I loved my eating disorder. I absolutely adored it. And it got me closer to death than my alcoholism did by far. I still miss my eating disorder. I think I'll always miss my eating disorder. It was just like alcohol was my best friend. It was always there for me, good days or bad. It always had my back. And as much as my Ed voice critiqued me, every once in a while it would throw me a bone and tell me I was doing okay. And that kept me hooked. I had a sponsor at the time, and she works an amazing program. She does amazing work. I was not doing amazing work with her. I remember calling her often saying, these people at Ridgeview are so annoying. They keep telling me that I have an eating disorder, and they don't know what they're talking about. How do I tell them to stop bringing this up? And she was like, well, just tell them you don't have one. And I was like, perfect. So that's what I did. And when you're sick, you seem to find some sick people to be around. I enjoyed hanging out with people who liked chaos. I enjoyed hanging out with people who fed that disorder. Yeah. So, by November of 2016, I was skin and bones. My organs were beginning to fail. And I was pissed because I wasn't as skinny as I thought I should be. I didn't think I looked that sick. I had seen anorexic girls before, and that's not what I thought I looked like. Luckily, I had a really solid network here. I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing, but I had people here who really loved me. And they all got together and called my therapist. And my parents called my therapist. And my therapist, who was an eating disorder specialist, brought up the fact that maybe I had an eating disorder. And I said, I may have some disordered eating. However, I do not have an eating disorder. And her words, she went along with that for a minute, and then session after session, it turned into eating disorder. And I started seeing a dietitian, and I couldn't stick with it. One of the things about my eating disorder, not only did it numb me out really well, like the drugs and alcohol used to do, and I couldn't use those anymore, so this is what I was using. It also gave me a sense of control. If I can't control anyone else, y'all say in this program, I have no control over anything. Fuck you guys, yes I do, I have control over my eating. But that thinking got me into treatment for 7 months. I was told by my therapist that I was going for an assessment, much like they do here at Ridgeview often. I would just go for an assessment. And I went for an assessment. She said, you'll just be there for 2 weeks. And 2 weeks went by and I was not gone. Then 3, then 4. Somehow I stayed for 7 months. I had to do a medical withdrawal from school. I'm in grad school right now to be a therapist. And one thing you got to do if you want to be a therapist is take care of your own shit before you can take care of anyone else's. So I needed to do this. At this time when I first started treatment for my eating disorder, she says I wasn't fired. I was kindly dismissed by my other sponsor because I didn't follow any of her directions, none of them. She told me to call every day. I did not do that. She told me to read stuff. I didn't do that. Anything she said was a good idea for her, but it wouldn't work for me. So I said, well, that's fine, because I have another sponsor anyways. I'm going to call Blessing. And she said, like I've heard this before, you need to pray about that. And I said, okay. And I got in the car and I called Blessing. And I decided that I was going to be honest this time about everything. And she was talking about the football game. This was right before I went to treatment. I hadn't ever said out loud that I had an eating disorder. And she looked at me and just asked me, she said, do you think you have an eating disorder? And I paused. And I decided that it was time to be honest now. And I said, yeah, I think I have an eating disorder and I think I need help. My parents were really worried about me. But this time they had learned from Ridgeview. They went to a lot of family weeks, a lot. And I remember the first family week they came to at Ridgeview, my mom just talked about how the closet at the house was really messy. It's the only thing she could talk about. Mind you, I had tried to kill myself the week before, but it's the only thing she could focus on. And this time she actually addressed the problem that was going on. And she also had some Al-Anon behind her where she knew that this was my problem. And she couldn't do anything to fix it. I was gonna have to decide to fix it if I wanted to, but she wasn't gonna sit there and support me if I wasn't gonna fix it. So they say I had a choice in getting better. It didn't really feel like a choice because I was still financially supported by my parents and I didn't really want to not be financially supported by them anymore. It seemed like I only had one option, which was to get better. So I was there for 7 months. And in those 7 months, I worked the steps, honestly. And the principle behind step one is honesty. And that's the first thing I got down, was being honest. Honest about why I'm not eating, honest about how I'm actually feeling. Apparently, when you start eating again, it's kind of like when you stop drinking, your emotions come back. So I was crying like every single day. But I was talking to people about it. For me, one of the most important things in this program is the we at the fellowship. Without this fellowship, I would have absolutely nothing. How cool. The friend that I had, the doormat friend that I had asked to come when I attempted suicide to save my ass, just got sober. And she called me for help. And she thanked me. She got to tell her story the other night at the treatment facility she went to. And she thanks me all the time. And I'm just like, Molly, I have treated you so poorly. Like, you should not thank me for anything. And she made her amends to me, poor thing. And she was like, Sarah, I stole some stuff from you. I was like, Molly, I know. She was like, okay, my sponsor said that would be okay to tell you because, like, you get it. I was like, yeah, it's fine. It's okay. Apparently, when you get healthy in all aspects, you start to attract healthier people. And the people who have chaos in their lives seem to dissipate. Be that friends or significant others. I had a dear friend. I think one of the hardest things in this program is we get close to people who are still sick. They may not be using, but they're still really sick, like I was at one point. And I met a dear friend here. I felt like I gave her a lot. I did a lot in this friendship. And I didn't get much back. And it was really disappointing. But that's one thing I've especially learned from Joe is I need to stay right-sized and I need to adjust my expectations. But you find some real gems in this program too. Blessing and Cam have been like second moms to me, and more recently Jen. Well, Jen's more like a sister. Because she's so young and hip. But these people help. You're young and hip too, Blessing. But these people have saved me. They have done absolutely everything for me. I show up at Jen's house all the time unannounced. I let other people in the house that she doesn't know who they are. which he was cute. I finally found a relationship that is worth having with a significant other. This person actually treats me well. I'm still working on my body acceptance, but he seems to do it really well. Not like that. Not like that. That's not what I meant. I meant the body acceptance thing. Am I turning red? He treats me really well. It's one of the first relationships I've had that I've been treated like a princess, like an absolute princess. My parents really like him. They think his drug using stories are really funny. he's also in recovery. And I couldn't imagine my life without him. Just like I couldn't imagine my life without the people in this room. I've been touched so much, and I've learned so much from everyone here, everyone I've met in the program, whether I've spoken directly to them or not. One big thing that I do that I signed up for before I was probably ready to was alumni. I was told I was a bit in disarray when I signed up for this position, but I signed up to be the chairperson for the patient meetings and relations. And the guy who was running it at the time said, you should really think about this. He was like, this is a lot of work, and I don't know. I was like, I don't have a job. I'm not in school. Like, it's fine. And that's been a huge thing for me, is being accountable and showing up. That's one thing I've learned from my sponsor now, is that when you say you're supposed to do something, you do it. Me and Joe talk about this a lot. We're judged by our actions, not our intentions. So today, I try and keep my actions in line with my intentions, and people seem to judge me in a lot more positive light. And as much shit as I've gone through, I'm really grateful for all of it, because I wouldn't be where I am today, and I wouldn't be who I am today without any of it. I'm grateful for the people who destroyed my life, and I'm grateful for the people who helped me rebuild it. I think I would be dead without Ridgeview in this program. I think I would be dead. And the sad thing is I'd be okay with it. Today I actually have a will to live. I want to wake up tomorrow. I want to call my mom, which is weird. I did family therapy this year, which is not fun. When I did family therapy at Ridgeview, my dad was asked to leave the session because he was being such an asshole. He was not asked to leave any of the sessions this year. People are finally proud of me today, but more importantly, I'm proud of myself. I can look at myself in the mirror and not hate myself. Do I have days where I dislike myself in the mirror? Absolutely, especially with my eating disorder thoughts still lingering. But I have people who unfortunately are very focused on the solution, so when I start to focus on the problem, they reorient me real fast and put me right back on the solution. But for me, this program's all about the we. It's all about the service work. It's about doing what you say you're gonna do. It's about meetings. It's about having a sponsor. It's about sticking with the winners, which is confusing because you're not supposed to judge people in the program, but there's winners in the program and there's not winners also. So you gotta stick with the ones who are doing it right and doing it honestly. The people who are genuinely happy, not the people who have the fancy shit and the shiny car. The people who have the beautiful hearts and the beautiful souls. Those are the people that I try and stick with. Like I said, I'm just so grateful for everything that I have today. And I wouldn't be here without Ridgeview and without the people in this room. So thanks for letting me share.
Nice job, honey.